How We Survive, Adapting to Climate Change from Marketplace is supported by Impax Asset Management, a specialist asset manager focused on the transition to a more sustainable global economy, helping investors be part of the solution when it comes to climate change. More at impaxam.com/invest.
I'm Molly Wood. You're listening to the Marketplace Tech special, How We Survive, Adapting to Climate Change. Columbia University researchers warned in April that the West might be entering a 20-year-long mega drought, and human-caused climate change is one reason why. And drought is an even bigger problem in places that have uneven access to water in the first place. In the Navajo Nation in the southwestern United States, numbers vary, but anywhere from 15% to a third of the population have no running water or access to clean drinking water. The need has been even greater since the pandemic because people need more water for hand washing and sanitation to stop the spread of COVID-19. One solution comes from the startup Source, which makes hydropanels, solar-powered panels that pull water vapor from the air and condense it into clean drinking water. A household system can produce up to 10 liters a day. It's not cheap. It costs $6,000, but private grants are funding access across the reservation. Milton So is president of the Cameron chapter in the Navajo Nation, where one family got Source panels this summer. He described the water they make.
When I was a child, when we went out hunting for small game, my grandfather, when the storm went through, you would have craters in the sandstone that held water. So we used to bend over and drink the water out of these craters, and it was pure rainwater. When I first tasted that water, I just flashed back to that part of my memory. So that's what the water tastes like, really clean and pure water, like it came from the rain.
Wow. And is it the one family in Cameron that has them right now?
Right now, yeah. People that don't have running water, you know, some of them have to drive an hour and a half one way to town to get drinking water. People say, well, water is not expensive. Sure, if you have access to the store that's around the corner, yes, but yeah. For us, the reality is that just going to the town of Flagstaff, you're spending $50 on gas and other things when you go buy water in town. A case of bottled water actually costing you around, you know, $60-$80, you know.
How often do people have to go? Like, can you estimate how much a month that might cost and how much somebody is, maybe this one household is saving with the hydro panels?
I would think they would go probably 3 days out of the week to get water. But we also have folks that still rely on their livestock, sheep, cattle, horses. So they're running almost daily to haul water.
Right. More broadly, when you look at bringing infrastructure to Cameron and the Navajo Nation, hydro panels, but also like renewable energy, new electric grids, do you feel hopeful that, you know, the reservation has a chance to maybe create a new vision of energy and water that isn't so destructive?
One of the things about the climate change also is that we get more sunlight now. And I think the tribe itself has a lot of interest in renewable energy. And, you know, this energy developed in our community here in Cameron could be sold to California and surrounding states. At the same time, we also would like a smaller scale of solar energy to homes that are off the grid. That way we don't have to run more wires on our land, you know, which is such an eyesore to me. There's a price you pay, you know, and that price is not only going to be coming out of your pocket, but are you willing to sacrifice the beauty of the land to get power?
I mean, do you think that could become a model for the rest of the country and other parts of the world?
I always tell people that are interested in trying something new in Cameron, we're willing to try it here, be the first. If it works here, it'll work anywhere.
Milton So is president of the Cameron chapter in the Navajo Nation. 17 homesteads on the entire reservation now have hydro panels. Source told us it's working with the tribe to install panels on 500 more homes. The Navajo Nation story is only one example of how climate change is a problem of inequality. Environmental justice is the idea that the effects of climate change are disproportionately felt in poor countries, poor communities, and often by people of color. So building resilience can't only be about one home, one tribal chapter, one town at a time. Melissa Roberts is the founder and executive director of the nonprofit American Flood Coalition.
So folks who can afford to do things like elevate their home or pay for, you know, flood proofing or things like that will be able to protect, you know, their belongings. And those with the least means, who are often in harm's way already, you know, won't be able to do those things. And that's just not a system that makes our community or our country resilient, and that just is not fair.
In fact, Robert says, when it comes to flooding in particular, sometimes adaptation can make things better for one place and worse for another.
You know, water often has to go somewhere. And so when one community builds a levee kind of next to a river that can overtop and, you know, flood the community, that levee that's there will prevent the water from coming into the community it's protecting. But once it gets pushed back from that community, it can actually rebound and make the flooding worse in surrounding communities that don't have levees.
This idea that wealthier communities create adaptation measures that can actually hurt other poorer towns, well...
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. This is not a new problem.
Jalon White Newsom works with water systems at the Kresge Foundation.
You can look over the past decades and see that it is the same communities and the same folks that continue to get the short end of the stick.
She says that systemic inequality simply won't work for climate adaptation. Because even if some people move away or some towns pay for resilience measures,
if we continue to plan in a way or think in a way, particularly the key decision makers, that we can just go ahead with business as usual, that those folks on the east side or those folks over there will deal with it, that's not going to be an answer, because ultimately this is going to be an even larger burden on society, an even larger burden on the economic line of many of these communities, because you're going to have to pay for it eventually.
Now, the type of systemic change that Melissa Roberts and Jalon White Newsom are calling for takes policy, awareness, and also business. And big tech companies are starting to make resilience and adaptation part of their portfolios. This fall, in response to water shortages made worse by climate change and the sheer amount of water consumed by tech industry data centers, Microsoft made a commitment to be water positive by 2030. That means it will both reduce its water use and replenish water it uses. Intel made a similar pledge last year. Lucas Jopa is chief environmental officer at Microsoft. He says there's a lot of opportunity for tech solutions.
One of the things that's been most exciting about the technology sector, I think, over the past couple of years is really this ability to put internet-connected sensors to be able to start saying, hey, there's not just water flowing through these pipes, we think, but there's actually X amount of water at Y time of, you know, of Z quality.
Jopa says Microsoft can use this data internally, yes, but over time, turn it into a product that other companies can use to manage their water. Because the thing about climate change is that it's a business risk that's only going to get bigger. And Jopa says this is a chance for the tech industry to do what it says it does best.
It's a societal risk. It's an existential human risk. Business is part of all of that. So it's also a business risk. It's also a huge and hugely exciting opportunity. If you are in any business right now, but technology in particular, you know, you are looking, hopefully you are inspired by bringing what makes your business special to the task of solving big, hard, gnarly problems, both because they're hard problems and you want to help, and also because if they're that big and they're that hard, then surely the rewards of solving them are going to be significant as well. You know, of course, we're trying to minimize that downside as well. Any business should be right now, but I wouldn't say that that's what drives our motivation. It's really thinking about all of these issues as one of the biggest big data problems our species has ever seen, one of the biggest compute problems our species has ever seen, one of the biggest markets that our society operates, and one of the biggest existential challenges that we've ever faced. I mean, when you look at the union of those four things and you don't see incredible excitement and incredible opportunity, I just think you need to look again.
Lucas Jopa is Chief Environmental Officer at Microsoft. Drought leads to fire, and lots of it. 2020 was the worst year ever for wildfires in the United States. In California alone, more than 4 million acres burned. Dozens died, thousands of structures were destroyed. And it's increasingly clear that we're going to have to figure out how to live with fire. Kimiko Barrett is a research and policy analyst for Headwaters Economics, a think tank based in Bozeman, Montana. She says we need to rethink how we build houses, where we build them, and even what they look like.
There's been a lot of innovation in just recent years, but there is a large component when you're starting to talk about replacement materials that are higher ignition resistance or non-combustible. There is a visual aesthetic that needs to be negotiated there with how homeowners' preference is. And so newer products are coming out to really try and mimic and look visually like that traditional building product, because people don't want to lose that feel of living in a log cabin in the woods. And so now products are coming out like concrete logs that look and feel very much like a wood product. It's still kind of coming up to speed. And I think a bigger piece of it is just the outreach to homeowners that they know that these products are available. And then there is a cost comparison you have to think about. And the differential cost that you're going to look at with respect to, say, a metal roof in contrast to an asphalt shingled roof.
What are the incentives that could push homeowners in that direction? Like, we see a lot of federal subsidies for things like solar. Could we start to see states or even the federal government do some kind of subsidy for more fire-resistant building?
Sure. Yeah, I think there's two big incentives. One would certainly be the fiscal piece, and that's what you're getting at with the subsidies. The other big one is just, I think, society's embracement of understanding that we are living in a very wildfire-prone landscape at this time, and that given ongoing trends, that these challenges, these risks are only going to increase into the future. We need to start thinking about how we're building differently. Homes that continually need to be rebuilt, homeowners are going to come to that point where it's a transformative event for them. They're going to want to build a home that can withstand a wildfire. And so then there's another marketing piece there that can actually be pushed, you know, of subdivisions that have been built to higher wildfire resistant standards being marketed as a community that's fire wise and that's set up to mitigate wildfire risks. And so that is another kind of educational outreach component that is yet to really reach the market, but I see a lot of value in that in the future.
Is the flip side, I mean, we know that all of this development in these wildland urban interfaces, WUIs, is a part of what's causing, you know, houses to burn down more frequently, for example. And I wonder, is there a danger if we think that we can construct fire-safe communities or fire-resistant houses that then we'll think, great, now we can build anywhere?
Absolutely. We, and I say we within the wildfire research community, would never articulate any new building or development as fireproof. That doesn't exist. And I think that needs to be recognized, that you cannot build any sort of structure that's going to have total 100% fireproofness against a wildfire event. What you're trying to do is to build a home that can withstand a wildfire and build in resiliency into the actual property and landscaping itself. And so that when a wildfire does come through, you're buying not only yourself some time to collect your things and evacuate if needed, but also for firefighters to come in and suppress that fire and be very effective with the resources that they have. So that's really the idea. Certainly there is, you know, this potential devil's advocate side that, you know, it's a free-for-all given development now in wildfire-prone landscapes because you're building a home that's higher ignition resistance. But right now, we're not doing any of that.
Kimiko Barrett is a research and policy analyst for Headwaters Economics. You heard her say that there's demand for homes that are built with more fire-resistant parts. Well, we found one. In Marin County in California, just north of San Francisco, there's a brand new home that was built specifically to be as fire-resistant and self-sufficient as possible. Hardly any wood, metal trusses designed for maximum airflow, a sprinkler system, solar panels, a backup power system for when the power goes out, and it's a luxury home, to be clear. Pool, sauna, views of Mount Tam. It was listed at just under $4 million and was sold in early December. Fanny Hansen is the architect. She was born in Bulgaria and now works in the Bay Area. She gave me a tour.
This particular galley is known to be very dangerous as far as the fire. And the fire marshal made actually the greatest compliment to me by coming and saying this is the house that it has to be a standard house. And in fact, it's because also it's a sustainable material, it's recyclable completely, so you don't really lose anything. Practically with this, we did it in the shops, so there was almost zero left over and very little material that came in the site and had to be wasted.
You can almost prefabricate.
Yes, and in fact, thank you, because most of the parts are prefabricated. And now in architecture, to really be good, it is a combination of lots of parts. And those parts, if they're economical, the cost get reduced substantially. And so you can see now the trusses are very standard, used in industrial area, and very inexpensive.
Yeah, let's walk around.
Thank you. Any question, you just, you know.
Oh, of course, I'll just shout it out. So what are the primary materials? Is it steel, concrete, glass? That's pretty much it?
Pretty much, yes. Now fireplaces. So now this is the big space, and this is a space for both living, working, enjoying, playing, anything. Now, it opens on both sides. So when you see here the Mount Tam, which is here, of course, the landmark, and it's incredible because the view changed every time, you know. The fog comes and it just goes down and spills, and it's a painting which changes all the time.
This is an expensive house, and part of that is, of course, where we are in California. But I wonder, do you think that this kind of building can translate into other, you know, wildland urban areas where
absolutely
people need to avoid
but
fire?
I have to say that, in fact, I really think this is the way to build in the future, because you can use standard components and incorporate them in a creative way to respond to the need, because the need is different than it was even a year ago. Mm-hmm. And the costs are really tremendous, so that has to be put all the parts together that could be done somewhere else and assembled on the site.
So this really could become an affordable way to build, like in new developments or for new houses.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I really think the cost of the air conditioning, only just take one component, I think majority of California has such a beautiful climate. And you can see now, you know, opening on one side, opening the other, the air goes through. You almost feel like you are in a tent, and one feels 100 times better. It moves also the leaves and so on. The pattern changes, and it creates incredible artistic interpretation of what really we have this wonderful world, and we're just bringing in.
Plus, you really save a lot of money on art. I mean, with all these big glass walls, you don't have to spend so much money.
Well, that's true, because the art is outside.
Mm-hmm. Fanny Hansen is an architect based in the Bay Area.
How We Survive, Adapting to Climate Change from Marketplace is supported by Impax Asset Management, focused on the investment risks and opportunities arising from the transition to a more sustainable global economy and helping clients invest in climate change solutions. ImpaxAM.com/invest.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.